Welcome to Hello Somebody, a production of the Black Effect Podcast Network and iHeartMedia, where we rage against the machine, where we raise our voices against injustice and stand up for justice, where we embrace hope and joy with an optimism for a brighter, more just future. Each week, I'll be dropping knowledge, whether it's a solo episode from me or a hearty discussion with esteemed guests doing great things in spaces and places of politics, entertainment, social justice, and beyond. We get real, baby. I mean, really real. We get honest. We get up close and personal for you. Yes, you. Because everybody is somebody. Before we begin, I want to give a special shout out to my team. Thank you, Sim, Tiffany, Sam, and the team over at Good Juju Studios, Erica England, Pepper Chambers, the hot one, and my social media team. Happy November, everybody. Look at us already in November. And this month is the perfect month to dig into activism. It is always the right time to talk about activism, leadership, and community. And I have the pleasure of speaking to the one and only Bria Baker. Bria is not only an activist and a writer, but she is also a freedom fighter. Hello, somebody. We do need, God knows we need, don't even get me started. We need more freedom fighters in the land, baby. Yes, we do. And so I am excited to talk to Bria about what she sees on the front lines, what she sees as one of some of the most pressing issues of our time, and what does she think about our collective future moving forward. So come with me, as you do every single week, on this amazing Hello Somebody journey. We're going in with Bria. Bria, hey, darling.
I am so honored to be here with you, Senator Turner. Thank you so much for that intro. Oh my gosh, I have to keep you in my pocket.
Oh, that's a high honor. As somebody who is introduced all over the world, I will say to you, I say the same thing. When I get a good introduction, I'm saying I got
right.
This person, right? Got to take this
exactly. Person. I'm like, I got to make that my ringtone, freedom fighter. I just loved how you said it. Thank you so much for having me.
No, you are that. I mean, you're a writer, freedom fighter. You've been working on the front lines for almost a decade, even as young as yeah. You are. And it makes me remember that a lot of times when we talk about the past and even sometimes the present, but I'm really thinking about the civil rights movement. I'm just going to channel that. Mm-hmm. In it. Mm-hmm. It was a generational proposition. And when we talk about it, we talk about it only in the sense of elders, which is fine. Mm-hmm. Because we need a continuum. We do mm-hmm. definitely understand that in the African-American community. However, a lot of the freedom fighters were also very young. You know, the freedom riders, the college students that sat at the lunch counters. I've spoken to some elders who were even children in the movement, you know, 10 years old, 11 years old, and they're still with us, who were very much a part because their elders at the time were in the movement. So it's definitely a continuum. But to be able to say that you have been in this for a decade is a lot for me to say. And you first started as a student, and now you are a national and global strategist. What does that mean to you? I mean, what were your first steps into the world of first activism, and how did you evolve to being an unapologetic activist?
Yes. Oh, my goodness. Well, first of all, I so agree with you as far as the emphasis that is on elders. And I think where it comes from is that we wait to celebrate people when they are elders, right? So a John Lewis was not being celebrated when he was the 23-year-old rabble-rousing. People thought he was a troublemaker, right? Yeah. And then he flipped that and was like, yeah, I'm a proud troublemaker. But we waited as a country to celebrate him until he was an elder. And then they like to soften the legacy and make it sound nice and palatable. And they don't want to say that he was out there leading the masses and boycotts and all of those things. So it definitely feels that way that we wait. But my first steps, it didn't feel like I was stepping into activism. It just felt like I was stepping into a mass of people that were tired of being tired. And I'm of that Trayvon generation, as we're called. And I was 17 the same year that he was assassinated by George Zimmerman. And I just remember that being a lot of firsts for me. It was at the time when social media was just coming out. It was the first time I engaged in digital activism. We took our photo as a family with the hoodies and the Skittles in one hand, the iced tea in the other. And after that was me constantly finding protests and rallies that I wanted to be at. And in those moments, I definitely considered myself more of a follower than an activist. If somebody was telling me, we're showing up at this intersection in New York City, I was hopping on my Long Island Railroad train to get to that protest and make sure that I was there. And over time, it became, wait a second, I'm going to the protest, but what am I doing in between them? And that is when I would say is when I really stepped into my activism and really being unapologetic about it. And for me, that was sort of, if I'm sticking with the Trayvon story, it was the non-indictment and the acquittal that really was like, oh, wait, we just did all of this for like a year and a half, and we didn't get the justice that we had been looking for. And maybe that's because we're showing up to the protest one-off and thinking that that's enough. And really we have to be doing something different, something in between. And that's when I really stepped into, wait, I got to learn from those who came before me, understand why are we still in this cycle? Because I don't want to see more of this happening. And I mean, now here I am 10 years later, and we're very much seeing a lot of that same stuff happening. And it's constantly forcing me to really reckon with, is our movement innovative enough to get out of the rut that we're in?
Yeah, those are all good points. And I cannot believe it has been 10 years, but it has indeed been 10 years. I want to pick up on a point that you made a little earlier before we deal with the point that you just made, which is we wait to celebrate folks until they are older. That is profound. I mean, I don't know. It touched me when you said that, because that is absolutely true. And we do kind of soften their positioning. Mm-hmm. Yes, Congressman John Lewis, the great, late, great Congressman John Lewis, making good trouble. He was making trouble. They called him a troublemaker. But when we look at others like him, the Stokely Carmichaels, you know, the Diane Ashes, and we could throw our sisters out there, it is absolutely the same thing. Mm-hmm. So we, being an American society, we do that. That's part of the American culture, unfortunately, because other cultures. So two parts to this. One, recognizing people in their youth for the work that we need to do a better job of that. And then secondarily, I believe we need to do a better job of also lifting our elders, because it can feel very much being thrown away because they're not in their youth. And I would love to get your take on that.
That's such a good point, because I do think it's a double-edged sword. It's not that elders are the ones who are being heralded and all of these things. What we find is that we wait a really long time to honor our elders. And then by the time that we are, it's almost like we're treating them as statues. And we're taking them off the shelf and saying, oh, now we want to do the John Lewis this and the John Lewis that. But when John Lewis was a young congressman and really needed that support and that professional development and that care and that mentorship, people were waiting for him to fall. And I see that happening now too, where it's, okay, I see this young activist, I might celebrate them here or there, but I'm waiting to see if they'll stick around. I'm waiting to see if this is a gimmick, if this is, oh, you're so cute, right? That cute activism. And I'm waiting to see if it's something real and substantive. But the reality is, if we were bothering to celebrate and support them along the way, we'd have a lot more activists sticking around and who are able to sustain years and years and years worth of work. But I think it's that thing of, okay, I'm going to critique you every step of the way. And then when I realize that your legacy is too strong to be ignored, I'm going to then try and co-opt it and say that I've been there the whole time. It's definitely what this country has done with Dr. King, right? Oh. He was not supported at all, especially right before he was assassinated, because he was touching on things. They were like, wait a second, it was cool when you were doing the black boys, black girls and white boys and white girls, but now you're talking about the Vietnam War. Yes. Now you're trying to unionize sanitation workers. We don't like that. That's a little too much for us. But now, decades later, you have some of those same people who not only like would have been, but were elected and pushing against Dr. King and are still elected and now saying, okay, we could do a Dr. King day. And at worst, weaponizing Dr. King against activists now and saying, oh, these young activists, they need to be more like Dr. King. If they were back in the day, you would have been saying the same thing to them. Oh, he needs to be more like this person. So I think it's how the powers that be get away with being on the wrong side of history, is that they try to pretend like they were right all along. Meanwhile, they're really diluting that person's message. And we have to be the ones that say, you ain't gonna do that. And I know that you're no stranger to that, because I see people doing that with you all the time. And it's like, no, you can't dilute a Senator Turner. I am the community I serve. I'm not talking to them, I am them. And when they can't do that is when they try and circumvent and take you down, or say, oh, well, actually, I think what she was trying to say was, it's like, no, I was clear. That was clear that first time.
Crystal. Yeah, no, I mean, Bria, that is very powerful. And, you know, Dr. Cornel West has a book that I do want to recommend to the folks who are joining us on this particular journey today, which is The Radical King. And I'm so glad you wrote that book, because just as you were saying, a nice way of saying that they softened even John Lewis, before he was Congressman John Lewis, they definitely have tried to soften what the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. actually stood for, from calling out white liberals to, you know, talking about economics, militarism, materialism and poverty.
Right.
I mean, he made it all the way out. And when he said, we coming for the check, hello, somebody. they don't want to talk about that. They don't want to talk about I have a dream, but they don't want to talk about that I'm coming for the check. And the critique he made, especially to white liberals, and that he much preferred to deal with the Ku Klux Klaner. This is what I'm paraphrasing. Mm. And the reason why he said that is because even when there's some hatred or disagreement at best, I want to deal with the person who I know where they coming from, even if we ain't rocking together, versus the person that's pretending and hiding behind when all along you are part of the problem. So we have some work to do, both as an American culture, but also especially as an African-American culture. I often talk about we have picked up other people's bad habits. And in a lot of ways, and the one that really gets to me the most, Bria, is how we treat our elderly. Because if all of us are blessed, you know, today's 20-year-old will be tomorrow's 50-year-old, and then 60, and then 70.
Right.
And in a more traditional Afrocentric culture, our elders are to be lifted and respected.
Yes.
That doesn't mean we got to agree with everything that they do, but we don't
throw
them away in this kind of tribal, you know, kind of culture that was part of West African tradition, you know, from the griot to the council of elders, you know, all of those things. And I'm not just saying lift somebody up just because they're elder and they're doing a disservice to our people. I do believe that there's a certain type of respect. But hey, you got to bring it to get it. Then we ain't gonna be cussing out no elders. Let me just say that.
Right. No.
But we don't always have to agree. But I guess what I'm saying is that I would love to see our community really connect with that part of who we are as a people.
So true. It's so priceless to be able to sit with elders who've done it before and be able to learn from their mistakes instead of going through it yourself. But also to realize that what I think I might know about you, I'm just scratching the surface. For example, I know that when the Black Panthers were coming around, it was so big on self-defense, because the idea had been, why are we cowering to whiteness and to white people, right? And it was that idea that we've got to be more protective of our communities. Yeah. And that came from a really beautiful place. And the deeper they got into their learning and their connecting with elders who had come before them, I think they were able to understand that it wasn't that people were cowering, but it's that they were responding to a very vicious reality. That when you go up against these systems, if you are not careful, they will come back with something you're not necessarily prepared for. And what we saw was how the Black Panther Party was taken down was a lot of those assassination attempts, the discrediting of the organizations. And that had been things that had happened to SCLC members before them, SNCC members before them, Malcolm X, who inspired them the most. And so when we get to sit and learn from our elders and say, oh, this is why you made the decision you made, we're not shaming them or blaming them for the decisions, even if we choose to go another way. And that's when I can see, when I see like young organizers now, and it's almost as if they're talking down at other past movements, you know, if you had done your job, we wouldn't be here. Well, I thought I've been doing a pretty great job the last 10 years and we still here. So that's not what it is. We just have to stop underestimating the people we're going up against and know that we can still be super intentional. We won't always get it right, but I'm certainly not going to blame those whose shoulders I stand on for doing the best that they could with the resources they had. And now that we have more resources, we may switch it up and revamp it. And that's why you bring both. You have the wisdom, you have the fresh insight, and it merges and comes together. And I'm so grateful for the mentors in my life that I've been able to learn that firsthand.
Yeah, amen to that, Bria. I mean, we need to put you having you explain that to some of your peers and even people younger so that we have a well-rounded view. And a lot of it was just flat out survival. You will be killed. You know, one of the reasons, I mean, there was a time when you couldn't look a white person in the face. There were laws and also, you know, de jure and de facto, what happens in reality and also what happens in law. And there was a lot of stuff that happened in reality that was not law. But in the South, you know, a black man especially, but black women too, you better not eyeball a white person to get you killed.
Yeah.
There were some laws on the book, codes on the books that said that black people couldn't talk loudly around white women. I mean, it will get you killed, lynched, right. Your stuff burned down. So a lot of the tactics that some of our elders use was both prudent for the moment because they were trying to live the continuous
right.
Damn
yes.
White. I mean, let's get that under, you know, understanding. And you're right. Mm-hmm. Being able to sit down and just, Stephen Covey, who's a world-renowned leadership guru, he says, seek first to understand and then to
yes.
Understand. Since we're talking about elders, who are some of the elders that inspire you? They could be dead or living, famous, or just somebody who you really love and the whole world might not necessarily know about them.
Yes, definitely. I'll do a little of both. I want to honor the elders who literally made my work in activism possible. I first began doing this work in a real way with Carmen Perez, who is the president and CEO at The Gathering for Justice, based out of New York and California. And she introduced me to Mr. Harry Belafonte, who's her mentor. And so I've gotten to sit at both of their feet and learn so much from them. And it was so beautiful because when I first came to know them, as a unit and as a pair who are doing this work at the Gathering for Justice, I was 20, Carmen was 39, and I believe Mr. Belafonte was in his 80s. And so it was just so cross-generational. And she's a Latina woman, me and Mr. B are both Black, but he's Caribbean. And so there were so many different perspectives, and just getting to hear from him how he was able to fundraise for the March on Washington, what his relationship with Dr. King was, what his relationship with other lesser known organizers was. I have learned so, so much, and it's inspired directly a lot of the work that I've been a part of since then, because I'm like, wait, he did this way and it worked really well. And I think there's an opportunity here in that same way. And it's just such an honor. Now Mr. Belafonte is in his early 90s and still going. And I think that reinvigorates me that, like, anytime I'm getting burnt out and tired, when, you know, I'm a very big proponent of rest. And I say, well, that's why we have a marathon. That's why we have people we pass the baton to, because he's still 93 doing it, because he was able to pass the baton when he needed to and then take it right on back. And he said, wait a second, I think I can be useful here. And that is what I can only hope for myself, is that I'll be in my 90s, still cultivating relationships with people in their 20s and younger and being a support to them in the ways that I can. So I am just so honored to sit at both of their feet and learn from them still to this day. And then I would say an activist in a different sense than people think of would be my paternal grandfather, Alfred Baker. And I think growing up, I had always aspired to the activism of people like an Angela Davis. I was like, I want my hair to speak for me, and I want to have a bullhorn in one hand and a picket sign in the other. And yeah. I still, you know, that's where you could find me, is getting arrested or with somebody's sign. But I found myself really understanding, to your point, that there are some people whose activism was their survival.
Come on.
And my grandfather is that kind of person. And he was someone who said, not only am I going to survive, I'm going to leave a legacy behind for my family. And as a young Black kid who grew up in North Carolina, moved in the Great Migration up north, and then went right back to North Carolina, he bought 86 acres for our family and was insistent upon land ownership being a form of activism. And he's no longer here now, but we all feel that through him and we carry that on, that there is nothing more important than owning what you've got. So nobody can take what you have, because you can't bully me. I have somewhere to put my head at night, regardless of what you do. And I think that is so important for us as a family to have. And I want every Black family to have something like that.
Yeah. Oh my God. I mean, I wish folks could see us. I mean, I'm fixing my seat. I got goosebumps. I'm like, amen. And in my mind, I want to jump in, but my other mind, let her get it out. Don't jump in. You know how sometimes people just talk, they ain't really listening. I am listening and wanting to call and response all at the same time. Bria, amen, amen, amen. And thank God for your grandfather's vision. One of the reasons why, and Sherman order number 15. Can we just pause right there for that? Can people imagine what the world would look like economically for Black folks had that General Sherman's order number 15 been realized in terms of the 40 acres they threw in
that mule?
Just the 40 acres. Even if we didn't get the mule, damn it, let's give us the 40 acres. Can you imagine your grandfather to really hold on to that? Because not everybody's grandfather or grandmothers held on to that. And for your grandfather had a kind of vision and imparted generation after generation is a beautiful thing, because land ownership is so important. I remember my grandmother, who was born in 1915, my mother's mother, you know, telling the story about her father owned land. And unfortunately, my aunts and uncles did not keep that daggone land. So I never had a chance to walk the land, but they did own land. And my grandmother would tell me that her father was always worried that the white man was gonna come and try to take his land. You know, he had his shotgun and baby, he was ready. And just even hearing you, oh my God. And not, you know, I'm not gonna fault my grandmother's generation. I mean, I wish they had kept the land. They didn't keep the land. So here we are.
Right.
To have somebody like your grandfather who really, really truly understood that and persevered through all of that is absolutely a beautiful, beautiful thing. And I am told that your grandfather's legacy continues to touch you even to this very moment, because you recently got married on that very land.
Yes. Oh, it was so special. We had an empty chair that we left for him with a photo of me and him on it, and one of his old flannel shirts hung over it so that he was there with us. And we did a land acknowledgement too. We honored the indigenous tribe whose land this initially was. And then we honored what it meant for a Black man to get that. Because I think a lot of people don't know, we've actually gone back in time. We've gotten worse when it comes to land ownership. So even hearing stories like that, it's not uncommon. And it's so unfortunate that in 1910, we had more land as a community than we do now. But it's also not something I fault us for, because I certainly have never had to go up against the barrel of a gun to protect the land that I got married on, right? And I can't, you know, we know the stories. We saw what happened to Tulsa. We saw what happened to Philadelphia, to the MOVE group. And so when you see those stories, you realize that you could do it all. You could be entrepreneurial, Black Wall Street, all this, and someone will still be threatened by your power. And I am grateful that we still have something to show for our land. But actually, the fact that he had to buy land in his old age, he used his pension to buy it. But his father had 600 acres in the early 20th century. So the fact that in a generation, we've been working to get some of it back, but we will never, or at least in this generation, I won't say never, you know, I'm working on it, but we won't have that 600 acres in one spot or the ability to work that much land the way that we once were able to. And that's very much because of the type of threats that you're talking about with your family. So it's so unfortunate. I feel every Black family that is not, you know, a recent migrant family, every Black family has a story like that. That's of right. Being ran out of a town, of being intimidated from doing something and from achieving what you really were called to do and be. And like you said, I just imagine, like, where would we be? You know, in the beginning of Black Panther, they're showing what the country looks like outside of the, what other people perceive it to be. They perceive it to be a farmer town. And then you go into the membrane and they see, oh, it's so modern. I wonder what we could be like as a people had all of that not been taken from us. But I see us pushing for it and demanding it all the time.
Amen to that. I'm telling you, we could just spend all the time
all day
talking about that. And you brought up MOVE, and I just want to remind people that Black Wall Street was in the 1920s. MOVE bombing was in the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
That is very recent history. I mean, this country is young, still young. When you think about it from the historical continuum, it's a baby nation compared to other nations that have existed for thousands of years. MOVE bombing in Philadelphia. And I want folks to go look it up, read about it. It happened in the 80s where the Philadelphia Police Department bombed Black folks on order. I mean, that's government. The government bombed citizens of this country right on this soil. And that debt still, you know, from Black Wall Street to that, debt still ain't been paid.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, talk about a debt not still paid. They're still compounding the harm, because it was this year that the families of the victims from that bombing found out that the remains were being held in the basements of an Ivy League university in Philadelphia. And so to even know that it's like, even in death, we do not have justice. We do not have autonomy. We do not have control over our story. We don't talk about that. And that's what conservatives, when they push against the type of curriculum that we really want to see in schools that is accurate, right? We're not demonizing anybody. They did that to themselves, but it's still happening today. And it's unfortunate that that's not a part of the mainstream canon. You have to listen to people like yourself to really get it, but we're not talking about it on a mass scale, the harm that's still being done.
No, we are not. And so past is informative. And the reason why we, especially as a Black people, but certainly indigenous populations and others, you gotta, you know, James Baldwin said, know from which you came. If you know from which you came, it's virtually no way you cannot. You gotta understand the past. And that is for us as a people. I would say any cultural group, and everybody has a culture. We have our global American culture, and then we have the culture of our people, our ancestors, our tribe. You gotta understand that. People whose ancestors hail from Germany need to understand that history. People whose ancestors hail from India need to understand that history, and so on and so forth. And there is nothing wrong with that. It's complicated for us,
right?
Because many of us, unless we are, you know, Black people in the diaspora, directly too, if you are African American, it is so much harder most times for you to be able to trace your lineage past the South. And it's a human yearning to know where you came from. And Bria, what is really bothering me right now is that we do have some white people. I will not say all, but this critical race theory that this GOP is up in a frenzy to something that has existed for the last 40 years that started off in law schools, and they're confounding this, making it seem like they're not teaching critical race theory in K-12, nor are they teaching it globally. Even in college, they're not doing it.
Right.
It's a red herring. And you know what? Exactly. Right. They don't want to talk the good, the bad, and the ugly. They don't want the bad and the ugly talk about the founding of this nation. And again, James Baldwin once said something like, you know, everything that's faced can't be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced.
Yes.
We got to be able to talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Right. It's because they know they're contradicting themselves. It's so interesting that a community of people whose big rallying cry for the last 4 years has been make America great again, and they don't want to grapple with what is the again. Like, let's talk about it. If y'all want to make America great again, what is again? What are you trying to return us to? And let me see if that's good enough and sufficient enough to serve this current community. But they want to talk about the again in that silo. And then when we start to pin at, well, what is that history? Then it's, I can't have this conversation. And that was so long ago. But you're the one bringing it up. We're trying to move forward. We're trying to say there's no point in our history that has been sufficient. And we want something new and better that serves all of us. Y'all are bringing us into the past. And then when we come there with our chalkboards and our lessons, you're upset. that we have the nerve to know the past that you're trying to bring us back to. So it's all because they don't know how to be consistent and principled across the board. And it's unfortunately not just them though, because there are many moderates in the Democratic Party that are in the same breath want to us to beg us, our people, to show up to the polls. And you better shame Black people, and they better stand in line as long as they did for sneakers. And every time we show up and do what we were supposed to do, and then we could see the exit polls like we saw for the gubernatorial race, and we see, wait, Black people did what we asked them to do. It's the white women that are not coming out for the party, who are always in a frenzy anytime the Republican Party does something against their interests. And again, we have to talk about the history of that being consistent regardless of which party we're in, or we're going to keep getting into these issues, and then we won't be able to get people to come out because they're going to know the pattern already.
That's it. And, you know, even with the election of Mr. Trump, it was the same thing. White women overwhelmingly put that man in office, and the second go round wasn't much better. I mean, let us not forget that he got, I think, almost 74 million votes somewhere.
Right.
So that's very telling. So Bri, you preaching the gospel. We're going to have to come back and do this game. Now, I want to make sure folks understand critical race theory. Like, I'm not going to break it all the way, just superficially. Critical race, because, you know, this man was interviewed from Virginia, and he said he was voting for the Republican, white guy. And he said, because that critical race theory that's being taught in schools, and when the reporter asked him what it is, he said, I can't get into the particulars. I'm not mad at him. You know, he seemed like just an average older white man who's been worked up into a frenzy. At least he told the truth. Look, I really don't know what it is, but I'm mad as hell about it. And the reason why he's mad is because of the rhetoric that is being pushed by the right wing. Critical race theory is an academic concept that is more than 40 years old, underline. Okay. The core idea is that race is a social construct. Sisters and brothers, family and friends, race is a social construct. It was created by folks to control people. We are all from one race, and that is the human race. But I digress, Bri. Let me go on and say this. So the core idea is that race is a social construct, and that racism is not merely the product of individual bias or prejudice, but also something embedded in legal systems. Hello, somebody. So ain't no K-12 teacher.
At all.
Ain't not teaching that.
At all. But they don't want even the semblance of race to be in the K-12. And that's, I think, the important thing, that they are so in a frenzy about the word race and the idea that race will be brought up in a classroom that they can't even understand. Like, oh, wait, well, unless your child is in law school, critical race theory ain't coming up for them.
For the most part, it's just not. And they really don't want us to teach America's history. Oh my Lord. So the role that Black women play, you know, in politics and media and organizing and education, that whole intersectionality that Professor Crenshaw really formalized. And that's why people use this. Some people use intersectionality because it sounds good to say. They don't even know what they're talking about. But anyway,
right.
You know, education, intersectionality, and controlling and creating our narrative as authors and writers. What has been your experience in that? And what recommendations might you have for women in particular, but not exclusively? We ain't gonna leave our Black men out, about really owning that and commanding your space as an activist, as a creator, whatever you're creating, as long as it's beautiful now.
Yes. Oh gosh, this is so real. I mean, especially when it comes to creating, it's just important in general for us to, one, own the narrative, because no one's going to get us right but us, right? You can't speak about or to someone that you don't know. But I think that puts us in a unique position. And I love this Angela Davis quote. She says, Black women have had to develop a larger vision of our society than perhaps any other group. They've had to understand white men, white women, Black men, and they've had to understand themselves. And then Angela Davis continues on to say, when Black women win victories, it is a boost for virtually every segment of society. Yeah. So I think because of that, it serves not only us, but it serves the community at large when Black people show up to the table unapologetic about saying, I know what is going to help me. And I know that anything that helps me as the most vulnerable person in society, or one of the most vulnerable and marginalized person in society, will help all of y'all. because if it's going to help make me exist in a more equitable space, that's certainly going to do that for Asian American, Pacific Islander people. It's certainly going to do that for non-Black Latinos. It's going to do that for indigenous communities, because we start talking about reparations, we got to start talking about land back, right? Like, it does all of those things. And so that's what it becomes unfortunate, though, because I think people love to say it, trust Black women, listen to Black women, but they love to do that when it's convenient, right? They love to listen to us when we have the same answer that they have. But when we're saying something different, they're like, well, I don't know. Do you have the experience to be saying what you're saying? Are you off the hinges and just, you know, trying to tear this community down? And I think we have to stand in our truth that we have always known what is best for this country. And anytime this country has listened to us has been the few times we have taken steps forward. And anytime this country has ignored our will, you talked about General Sherman's order, right? Like, anytime it's ignored that, we've gone back in time. And so it's so important that we not second guess ourselves, that we not step into rooms with imposter syndrome, because I don't need any validation from a white institution or a person to tell me that what I know to be true about my community is true. Like, that's just a fact you cannot ignore. And that's why I love people like you, because it's so clear and apparent that anytime you step in the room, it's, you're going to get hello somebody, whether we at a fundraiser, whether we at a church, whether we at the podcast, whether we walking down the street and I'm campaigning, whether I'm in the room presenting something. And that consistency is something that you can't bottle up and sell. You just got to be authentically yourself and trust that when people listen, they will get it.
Yeah. Oh my God. And just owning our agency too. I mean, it took me to be a grown ass Black woman. Some people are born knowing this is who I am and this is where I'm standing. And others of us, it takes a while. And society will beat up on you, particularly Black women, not to be authentically who we are. We got to be somebody else. And we don't all communicate to the world in the same manner.
Right.
And a pain and a trauma that is there in being in a Black woman's body. And I would even throw colorism out there too, Bria.
Yes.
Definitely have to deal with as both a society, but particularly as a Black community. But we've been brainwashed. The closer to white you are, baby, the more beautiful you are. And we carry that burden that's been placed in us unless you deconstruct your construction. And that is why for me, I wish 12-year-old Nina or even 15-year-old Nina had have had the Black Panther. But I'm glad that Nina, as she is today, did not leave this earth without having a movie of that magnitude that spoke to so many strengths in who we are as a Black people, and to show the rainbow mosaic of who we are, to show also that, you know, hair and weaves and all of that is not the end all be all. And shout out to my sisters who do that, because I've been through that too. I'm not throwing shade. But it is for us to embrace who we are as we come, and that our culture is vibrant and brilliant. It was the centering of Black in all of our beauty, in all of our beauty. Yes. And I'm telling you, I must watch that movie at least 7 times a year, because it's so reaffirming and so many lessons to be learned from that I think we definitely as a people should pick up on this. Mm. So let us talk about, you really believe, as I do, that Black people, but Black women in particular, I know I keep saying that we got to own our rest.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh my God. Let's rest there for a minute. Talk about rest. Can we just settle there and talk about why, and even in all of your activism, you are inspired to point out that there is a need for people who are in this fight to deliberately seek self-care, rest, so that they can refuel for the journey or the battle.
Oh my goodness, yes. I mean, you just said that was perfect. The refuel for the battle piece is so key, because you can't pour from an empty well. And there are a lot of activists who are running only off of their anger. I'm angry enough at this system to keep going. But as soon as your body remembers, like, wait a second, I had a millisecond to remember how exhausted and tired I am, you will shut down. And that is also how we lose people to these fights, right? People who don't get the chance to refuel. I think about an Erica Garner, because of course we talk about victims of police brutality, right? But we don't talk about, this system makes the families fight so hard, they kill themselves just fighting for justice. And Erica Garner was 27 and died of a heart attack. That should not be
her baby, Bria. And I'm sorry, right. I am deliberately jumping in on this. I hope you don't lose your thought.
No, please do.
I knew Erica. I was, you know, Erica saw me as a mentor. I first met her in 2016 when Senator Bernie Sanders was running. She endorsed him. That commercial that many people saw, that was her creation. That was her vision. The experts in commercial making took her vision, and brought it to life. I remember being at the Apollo with her, Bria. And Charlamagne, the guy, he was the moderator. Mr. Harry Belafonte was
there. I was there, yes.
Erica was there. I was there. And oh my God, it just gives me chills just to think about how hard that young sister was fighting to keep the life of her father and to bring justice to him alive, and what she went through emotionally and physically, so much so she birthed her baby into the world, and shortly after she had a heart attack. It's just making me tear up.
Yeah.
I think about everything that she did and what was left to be
for her to do. Yes.
So I'm sorry. I wanted to.
Don't apologize. I'm so glad that you could bring in that personal element. I had organized with her a few times on a few occasions. And as you said, she gave her everything for justice and for the city to take all of that. And then even after her death, to barely get the justice that she deserved, to say, we're not going to let this happen again on our watch. They didn't commit to that. And it's so frustrating to see that happen, because then it says, I would have rather her been alive than for her to go blue in the face, yelling at this system, yelling at this mayor, yelling at this governor, and get nothing in return for it. What did we get for her sacrifice? It wasn't a sacrifice. She didn't sign up to be a martyr. And it's so unfortunate that so many activists and families of victims of police brutality and other injustices have to send themselves into early graves pursuing even a semblance of justice. And I don't want that. I want her bouncing a baby on her lap. I want Erica Garner going to a graduation and saying, this is for your grandfather who you didn't get to meet. And now that baby is going to have to mourn the both of them and know that that's a part of their legacy and have to heal through that, right? We're creating generations of trauma. And I'm committed to, as my sister in this work, Taylor K. Shaw, says, to creating generational leisure for Black people, and to say we deserve all of the rest that we can get. And there's something I think we get so caught up in, like the symbolism, and we gotta stay fighting. And I really think, like, when my ancestors, who were sitting in a rickety little shack in North Carolina, when they dreamed of freedom and liberation, they, you know, listen, I love a vacation like the best of them, but I don't know if that was in their vision. I think they visioned waking up on a Sunday and that not being their only day of rest. I envisioned them waking up on a Wednesday and saying, what am I going to do today? And having the choice to choose that. And so when we, who are in some ways so much more freer than them, but when we allow ourselves to be shackled by other people saying, oh, you can't do that, you can't take time for yourself, you can't rest, whether we tell it to ourselves or we allow people to tell us, we are in that same place. Like, if I tell myself, oh, I got to wait until I've achieved this thing to rest, we are delaying the liberation that was so hard fought for. And I just refuse to get to that place. Well, my body needs a nap, I'm taking a nap. Like, it's just gonna happen, because I know that my grandfather's grandfather didn't have that luxury. And if one thing I'm gonna do is rest when somebody tells me I can't. And I'm so grateful for people like Naomi Osaka, who are telling us that too, right? Who are saying, oh wait, you thought you was gonna wring me dry and get everything you wanted out of me? Absolutely not. I will leave this industry before I let y'all take everything from me at the age of 23. And I love that. I love that.
Yeah, I'm right with you. One of the gospels that I preach to along the trail, and it's more, you know, when I think about the struggle, it is both caste and class. And when I talk to the class struggle, which there's an intersectionality, Professor Crenshaw, to the class struggle, I say that we are in a society right now that values, that definitely puts a value on the lives of people who have the most money and want poor people to work their fingers to the bone for pennies, while CEOs and other folks get platinum parachutes. Even when they monk up a place, they get millions and millions of dollars to lead the place. But now we got to beg people for a $15 an hour minimum wage. People got to work even four jobs to make ends meet. Rhea, where's the rest in that? They don't get the rest. Do they deserve to be able to buy a certified used car every now and then? You know, I say that all the time. Right. Do they get a right to take a vacation, even if it's just going around the corner down the street?
Right.
They get, right now, even in that Congress, you got some of these selfish ass Congress people that are trying to negotiate away, even paid family and medical leave. So now a poorer woman or a working class woman and father, they do not get a chance, or family and friend members, do not get a chance to take some time off to be with their baby that they just birthed in the world. Or if one of their parents gets sick, they don't get the time. They have to decide whether to spend the time with those their family members or lose their job.
Right.
Stress kills. Poverty kills. So Bria, I am with you. Let's reclaim that. And especially Black, I love the way you say, hey, I'm taking mine because my ancestors could not, because y'all worked to death, literally.
Right, literally.
Death. Mentally, physically, and spiritually.
No, truly, in every sense of the word. And it's like, I'm certainly not going to do all this for a country that can't even apologize for what they did, let alone teach it and acknowledge it. There ain't no way I'm going to put myself in an early grave for a country that won't even say, like, the fact that it had to be a Black person and his nonprofit to build the only museum acknowledging lynchings and the legacy of slavery in this country. But we've got to listen. I can be on this soapbox all day, but it's truly, I'm not going to do it before this country commits to reparations. Now, once we've acknowledged and talked about real equity in this country, then we can be on equal footing that says, well, we've all got to put in our, but no, my price has been paid by my God and by my ancestors.
There it is. We 400 years behind, so y'all got a lot of making up to do.
Right, I'm charging interest.
Like Dr. King said, coming for the check. Yeah, we are.
Yes.
And a whole lot of other stuff, too. Oh, my God, Bria, this has been so, so good. You got to promise me that you are going to come back and be with us on Hello Somebody. You are such a bright light. You illuminate the place. And I am so glad that you are within your mission, you know, what you believe that the Creator called you to do. We all have a purpose. I firmly believe that. Everybody got to find their purpose. And yes, you have certainly found yours, and you are just getting started. Can you tell us a little bit before we part for now, because we're coming back together, about yes, the book that you're writing about Black land ownership and the long-term impacts of land theft.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Well, yeah, first of all, it is an honor to even hear you saying that, Senator Turner. So I would love to come back and we can key it up. But I'm so excited about this book. I'm publishing it with One World, who is just an imprint of Penguin Random House that is known for speaking truth to power. And so I feel in such good company there. It's the home of Nicole Hannah Jones's 1619 Project, okay, and of Ibram Kendi's books. And there's so many brilliant writers there. And I see this book as an opportunity for us to reckon. I think there have been so many who have talked about our criminal justice system and have talked about pay gaps and all of those things. And I feel that there has been a missing puzzle piece about how much has been stolen from us even since slavery. Because people say, oh, it was so long ago. We know that slavery was not that long ago. Mm-hmm. But even if we're going to accept the lie that it was, the land theft has been so much more recent and is still happening. And so I think people know about the Tulsas, but they don't really know about the everyday stories of families who migrated, not because they were like, oh, I think the North would be nice to visit. Oh, I think I might have some cool economic opportunities. They fled in fear, right? Truly refugees in every sense of the word, leaving everything behind. And oftentimes that property got sold or bought up by someone who didn't have the right to sell or buy it or take it. And we now have this gap that we can't get out of. And we have a lot of families that are working class and don't have a positive net worth to show for themselves, not because they don't work hard, but because they've had everything they've worked for taken from them. And I really want to tell that story. I really want people to see the timeline of that theft and see the impact, not just on us, but I think an important part that's coming up in the book is that it's hurt everyone. The quality of the land and the air and the water is significantly worse now that Indigenous and Black communities are not the stewards of the land. Now that we've got these major corporations and Monsanto and Continental Can Company, all of these companies that take and extract everything they can from the land, we've got communities that get hit by a hurricane and are just wiped out. We've got communities that can't, that are having tornadoes, and that was never a thing before. And I don't think that we've been equating that the climate disaster we're in has partly been because the people who used to own the land and work the land were people who were in relationship to the land, that treated it like the living thing that it is. And now we've got people who said, oh, wait, well, after 100 years of only growing cotton on it, only growing tobacco on it, now you don't want to yield anything for me. And this land doesn't feed us the way that it was. And we are so abundant in land, but it is being hoarded by a select few people. And that's what I'm hoping this book can really help people see, is like, we've got to get it back. The promise of reparations is not something that's too, it's too late to deliver on. We can and should still deliver on it. And what we're seeing now with Bruce's Beach, for example, in California, where a family that had their prime real estate taken from them is getting it back. We can do that around the country and see what it does for not just the racial wealth gap, but also the quality of that land, for the access that other people have to it.
Yeah, and for us all, and when you talked about when you elevate, lift, and have a reckoning with some truth and reconciliation, and a reckoning with what happened to African Americans and their descendants, or Africans first, and then their descendants, which are African Americans, it does lift everyone, and people need to see it that way. Heather McGee wrote a book, The Sum of Us.
Yeah, The Sum, yes.
Right,
yes.
And hearing you talk reminds me of that, because she's very clear in that book. I am laying out the summation of what being anti-Black, being racist, being bigoted, done not to the just the Black community, but to all of us, and how we can get back to that, to maybe not back, because we've never really been there, but the collective consciousness that changes what is to what can be. And I think your book is certainly going to shine a beautiful, beautiful light. I cannot wait to read it. I cannot wait to interview you about it. When is it scheduled to come out?
2023. So maybe we could talk next year again about it, and it'll be in a firm place. But I am so excited for you to read it. I'm gonna make sure you get one of the first copies.
Please. And we're gonna come back together way before 2023. I would love, again, you are such a bright light. And another point that you made as we gather ourselves for this session, about that not being so long ago. We don't even have to go back to the enslavement of our ancestors, the broken promise of the 40 acres and the mule, but even just in 2008, Bria, and I'm sure you're going to deal with that, Black people lost half of their wealth because of their home ownership exploded during the Great Recession. Even that has not been dealt with.
Right.
We just 2008 before we get to go all the way. We haven't even dealt with 2008. And also the fact the government, the properties, the home values of people who live in most Black communities, certainly not all, is less than that of our white sisters and brothers and family and friends. And so that theft has been generational, and we can just stick in the 21st century. Don't even let it going back to the 20th century and the 19th century and the 18th. We can just rest.
Stay right here. And it's so sad, because to merge all the conversations we've been having, there was a recent, you know, I'll give President Biden a little kudos here, though I have a lot of critiques, right? But he had earmarked several billion dollars of funding to go to Black farmers in repair for USDA discrimination that had happened in the 1900s. So we're not talking anything else before that, but just the USDA's discrimination. Okay, we're gonna earmark some billions of dollars to repair that, and we're gonna tie it to some COVID funding, because we know that y'all are also being hit hard in this moment. And that funding was supposed to go out, and then white farmers sued. And now that funding is staying in limbo because they're claiming reverse discrimination. And it's just so clear how little we know about our history, that anybody could be accusing Black farmers of reverse discrimination when in regard, like, they have been on the front lines of so many different fights. And so it's clear we've got to educate people better. We've got to see our solidarity, because the reality is any funding that makes it to Black farms will then be feeding communities, and then we'll be addressing a lot of the areas that white America is trying to figure out how to fix in Black communities, right? So it's just working against the interest, and we need white farmers and white people in general to see themselves as part of our fight and say, wait, not only am I not going to stand in the way, but I'm going to be a really loud voice in the chorus saying that you deserve better and I want you to get it. as opposed to thinking that our liberation comes at the expense of theirs. Because once we start addressing racial justice, we'll also be addressing class justice, and we'll be addressing the white working class folks who have been passed up. But we can't even get there because they won't let us finish the sentence, right? Yeah. So there we are.
No, that solidarity is real. Again, the sum of us, okay?
Yes.
It is definitely real. It makes me think of what I say to people if we just close our eyes right now. And I want everybody that's here with three of myself, just if you're driving, don't close your eyes. But if you're just walking around or laying around, just maybe not even walking. If you're standing or sitting or laying, you just close your eyes and just picture us on a beach, and that each and every one of us had a pail. And the person that's the host on this beach says, get as much sand as you can. Now, before you close your eyes, you can see sand further than what the eyes can see. And if all of us had pails and we were instructed to get that sand, you wouldn't look to the left or to the right or to the front or behind of you and be threatened by how much sand the next person puts in their pail. Because you can see sand. I mean, sand exists beyond what you can see. That is what this moment is about, Bria, that we got to get working class solidarity across gender and sexual orientation and religion,
race, ethnicity,
and say, damn it, there's enough sand for all of us. Now, some of us deserve a little more because of the historic hurdles. But when Bria gets her sand, that makes me better. Hello?
Yes.
Now,
Oh my God.
That's it. Enough sand on the beach.
You just dropped the mic right there. That analogy is so perfect. There's enough sand for all of us.
All of us, baby. Mm. Let's get collected. But it does cause us to have some courage to recognize that certain injustices exist and were done based on somebody's race and ethnicity. Those are facts. You can't read history, but your justice doesn't impede on mine. As a matter of fact, it enhances my justice.
They don't get it. Because if they got it, we would see a lot different things in the current society that we're in. But I think that enough people are beginning to get it, right? We're in this period that people are calling the Great Resignation, and people are unionizing left and right and are saying, I deserve better in the workplace. We're in a racial reckoning where all communities of color are saying, I deserve better everywhere that I go. And I really believe that people are beginning to wake up to the fact that, wait, I've been blaming this person next to me. And it's that person up. It's somebody up there who I'm not seeing, but their invisible hand is what's pitting me against you, and I won't let them win.
Won't let them win. Solidarity, baby, forever. Yes, yes, yes.
Hello, somebody.
My God, Bria. This is it. We got to have you come back. We have got to get you back on Hello, Somebody. It has been an absolute pleasure and honor to be in conversation, this deep, powerful, emotional conversation with you today. And I look forward to watching your growth and all of the things that you are going to continue to do to uplift humanity. Hello, somebody.
Thank you so, so much, Senator Turner. And I am so grateful to you for who you are and what you bring to every space that you enter. And thank you so much for this conversation and for those to come. And I can't wait to stay tuned with you on the journey.
Oh, thank you. Back at you. I so enjoyed it. Hello, Somebody is a production of iHeartRadio and the Black Effect Network. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.